Chapter 21.
Okay, for the record, what you're doing is nothing like dogs barking, and I object to the whole bow chicka bow wow meme in principle.
Oberon, please, this is not the time.
This is the perfect time. It's the first time you and Guanyuel have participated in this bow chicka bow wow behavior.
It's not meant to mimic dogs barking. It's mocking 70s funk music heard in pornographic videos, specifically the bass line. May we have some privacy, please?
What? You want me to go away?
Well, just don't stare at us. I didn't sit and watch and make comments while you were with Fifi, did I? Talking about giving the dog a bone and such.
Fine. But human mating habits are stupid.
Chapter 22. We did stop eventually, but only because Oberon threatened to chew off his leg as the sun set for the third time since we'd begun.
I'm desperately bored of being a watchdog, especially since I have to watch you two be grody together.
Now, hold on. First, you didn't have to watch, because I specifically suggested that you not do so. And second, it wasn't grody. It was the stuff Al Green sings about.
You were the one who told me that proverb thingy. Grody is in the eye of the beholder.
No, Oberon, that was beauty.
Whatever. It works for Grody, too.
Nothing could ruin my mood right then, so I laughed and admitted he had a point. How about a hunt, Oberon? Would that suit you? My hound put his nose in the air.
That depends. What are we hunting?
Anything you want. Anywhere you want. Granuel needs to practice shifting planes and shifting shapes.
I want to hunt dick-dicks.
All right. Tanzania, here we come. While Granuel was now a full druid, she still needed some coaching and practice on what had been theory until this point. She'd memorized the words and the forms of the knotwork admirably, but because we'd been so busy lately, she had yet to cast anything. We thanked Pyrenees for his hospitality and help before we shifted to Eastern Africa. Granuel and I both placed our hands on a tethered tree, and I showed her amongst the myriad trees where to shift in Tir na n'Og. You go first. We'll be right behind you.
What if I get lost?
You won't. I'm going to follow wherever you go. She took a deep breath, closed her eyes for a moment, and shifted.
She's going to be talking to me soon, isn't she?
Oberon said. Yep, very soon.
Well, before our conversation gets put on speakerphone, I want you to know that you're my favorite human.
Ah, thanks, Oberon.
Even when you're grody.
That's very generous of you. Oberon's nose lifted in the air again, but not for the display of any attitude. His nostrils flared.
Atticus, I smell the dead. Lots of them coming this way.
I frowned at my hound. Vampires?
Unless we miss the zombie apocalypse, I'd say so.
All directions?
No, from this side of the mountains.
So there would be French vampires. Perhaps the vampires from the Iberian Peninsula wouldn't be far behind. After my conversation with Theophilus, I could well imagine that he'd given the command worldwide to hunt us. I certainly hadn't ceased to train my apprentice, so I must assume that his promised pogrom had begun and the world's vampires were sniffing us out. It probably wouldn't be all that difficult to find me, provided I stayed in one place. My ancient blood smelled different from that of modern humans, and if they'd been told by their mysterious fey connection that I was binding Granuel to the earth, they'd know to search the wild places in Europe. I had no desire to remain and take on an unknown number of vampires, so I shifted to Tir na n'Og and found a relieved Granuel waiting for us. She did a couple of pogo jumps in the dark.
I did it!
Indeed. And now, let's go to Tanzania. Lead the way again. We spent some time finding an appropriate place to shift. We chose some acacia woodlands in Lake Manyara National Park, and then we went ahead as before, with Granuel going first.
Are you going to tell her about the vampires?
Oberon asked once she'd shifted. Soon. I need to think about it a little bit. She has enough to worry about at the moment. When we reached Tanzania, which was humid and warm and full of animals eating one another, we both had our night vision on. Granuel was giddy.
Can I shapeshift now?
Wait a moment. Bind with Oberon first.
Oh, yeah. Duh. I'm sorry, Oberon. I'm just so excited.
She's dancing like she has to go to the bathroom.
He understands, I told her. Okay, so, look at the connection between Oberon and me in the magical spectrum. You need to bind yourself to him in the same way so that you can hear his thoughts and vice versa.
Will you be able to hear my thoughts too?
No. The only person I know capable of human telepathy is the Morrigan, and she doesn't accomplish it through traditional bindings.
What if we're both in animal form?
Granuel asked.
Do we use Oberon as a go-between to speak to each other?
I suppose we could.
If you want to drive me insane.
But we should probably try to keep that to a minimum, I added. Granuel nodded.
Poor dog would probably go nuts.
She's a bit more sensitive than you, Atticus.
Hey!
Give me 2 months to work on her, and I bet she'll get me a French poodle.
Do not take advantage of her generous nature.
Are you serious? You might as well ask me to stop being a hound.
Granuel gave a tiny gasp, and her eyes widened.
I heard that, or the end of it. Why would you want him to stop being a hound?
Hello, clever girl.
Hi, Oberon. It's so nice to finally hear your voice. Is clever girl your name for me?
He's been calling you that ever since that business with the skinwalkers. Watch out, he's buttering you up for something.
Is that so?
Her eyebrows asked a question of my hound.
Ignore the surly druid. I have no shadowy agenda. I am motivated by food.
And tonight, you're hungry for really tiny antelopes.
That's right. But I'll settle for whatever we can catch.
Okay, I've never hunted before, so you'll need to give me some tips and forgive me if I screw up, all right?
Tonight, I will cut you infinite slack.
Good, because my predator form is a giant black cat.
You're a cat person?
Oberon whipped his head around to me.
Atticus, you never said anything about that.
It wasn't my choice, Oberon,
Granuel said.
Gaia chose my predator form. If it had been my choice, I would have been a wolfhound like you and Atticus.
That's true, buddy, I said privately. She didn't have any say in her animal forms. Besides, what does it matter? She's Granuel no matter what shape she's in.
Well, that's a fair point,
Oberon admitted.
What is?
Granuel asked.
He said you'd still be clever girl, no matter what your shape is.
Oh, that's true. Atticus, maybe we should speak aloud to Oberon whenever we can, so we don't have to always ask him for clarification when he answers.
Yep, good idea. I'm used to keeping a lid on it, so it will take me some time to break the habit.
Let's hunt!
Granuel and I disrobed and placed our clothes near the tethered tree. We asked the earth to part and conceal our weapons for us. One more thing before you shift, I said. I have to fix your necklace.
Oh.
Granuel raised her hand to the cold iron amulet dangling at her throat.
Good call. I would have garroted myself.
Would you mind terribly if I did this for you? Fix it so that it changes sizes with your shape? I could teach you how, but it would take a while.
No, go ahead,
she said. You'll have to shift to every form to do it properly, and I know you've been dying to anyway. I moved around her and unfastened her necklace, noting as I did so how much slack and extra chain there was. Then I stepped away with it in my hand. So, let's take it from the top. Horse first. Go. Granuel spoke the words that would bind her spirit to the form of the horse indelibly tattooed on her arm. She shifted to a beautiful copper-colored chestnut, sometimes called sorrel, with her mane slightly lighter than her coat. Her nostrils flared and she sneezed. I told her what she looked like as I adjusted the necklace around her neck and memorized the size and position. She whinnied and stamped on the ground with her hooves, one leg at a time, no doubt marveling that she had four of them. I crafted the first part of the binding that would allow the necklace to shrink back to human size when she shifted. Okay, shift back to human. I know you want to run, but this isn't the best place to do it. There are leopards in the trees here and other hungry things. Granuel snorted and shifted back to human form.
Atticus, that was amazing! Four legs, hooves, incredible!
I know. Check your necklace. She looked down and saw that the necklace was fastened around her neck exactly as it had been before.
You rock. Don't swell his head. It's already the size of a zeppelin.
I unfastened the necklace again. Okay? Kitty form. Granuel shifted and became a sleek black jaguar. I could tell by the shorter, thicker tail and the wider head. She sneezed a couple of times here, too. Congratulations, you're a jaguar. Granuel's joy at this news elicited an extremely loud roar, startling Oberon and me and the surrounding woods into silence.
I think every creature near enough to hear that just pooped, Oberon said, and then it went into hiding. Hunting tip number one, stay silent.
Granuel lowered her ears and managed to convey a sense of regret. I took measurements for her necklace and had her shift back to human.
Sorry, Oberon, she said as soon as she got her voice back. It's Helen Reddy's fault. It was the whole, I am woman, hear me roar thing.
No problem. You still have infinite slack.
All right, I said, retrieving the necklace. Let's see what kind of bird you are. Fly a bit if you want, but don't keep us waiting long. Granuel shifted, and I whooped. You're a peregrine falcon, fastest bird alive. Fly, be free. With a screech of victory, Granuel took wing. For a moment, it was a majestic scene out of Animal Planet. And then, it wasn't, as she promptly crashed after an awkward banking maneuver. She tried again, crashed again, and then, on her third attempt, climbed toward the moon so she could dive back down at 200 miles an hour. When she landed in a sort of sprawling skid and shifted back to human form, she groaned and clutched her stomach.
Oh, Atticus, I don't feel so good inside.
It's because you've been shifting back and forth so quickly. When you thumb your nose at the laws of physics like you've been doing, the universe tends to get you back through biology.
I'm not permanently damaging my spleen or anything, am I?
Nope, it'll fade. It's just a pain you can't heal or suppress. How was your flight?
So awesome. The third one, anyway. I can tell I'm going to enjoy that form a lot.
I'm sure you will. Last one, sea lion. She shifted and clapped her flippers together. Oberon chuffed at her, and I chuckled as I adjusted her necklace. Okay, now hold still in this form a while. I'm going to make all the forms and sizes recursive so that you can shift directly from horse to falcon or jaguar to sea lion, and the necklace will change properly along with it. A few minutes, and it was done. Okay, shift to jaguar from this form, and we'll hunt.
About time,
Oberon said. Granuel shifted to her jaguar form, and I shifted to a wolfhound. We both sneezed. My coat was reddish with a white stripe down my right front leg where my tattoos were. I looked like a slightly different dog, since I was in truth one of the old warhounds of the Irish that eventually were bred to become the deerhounds and wolfhounds of today. It made no difference to Oberon, though. To him, I was a wolfhound, part of his pack.
Okay, now take a really deep breath through the nose,
Oberon said to Granuel. She did, and promptly began to sneeze uncontrollably, more violently than she had upon her initial shift. She even tried to cover her mouth with her paw, which was pretty funny.
Heh, never knew the world could be so pungent, did you?
Granuel managed to find some space between sneezes to growl at him.
Ah, you'll get used to it in a few minutes. Okay, we need you to lead us to some dick-dicks without running into any baboons, hippos, crocodiles, or other big cats.
We failed miserably to find any dick-dicks, but Oberon wasn't the least bit disappointed. He was highly amused by the entire trip, because Granuel kept sneezing and didn't get used to her new sense of smell. She'd always been a bit sensitive to odors. Her first exposure to demons had caused her to retch miserably for 10 minutes. Once we passed near an impressive pile of rhino feces, she gagged and tried to run away from it, but her gagging turned the normally smooth mechanics of a jaguar into a jerky, trembling dance. Oberon chuffed so hard he fell over and pawed helplessly at the sky.
"You know, I've basically been bored for 3 months while Granuel was getting bound, but now I'm good. I feel we're paid. Never thought I'd see a jaguar brought to its knees by rhino shit. And it probably dumped that here when she roared."
Granuel was still gagging and trying to pull herself away from the smell on the ground, her belly on the grass of the savannah. Then she remembered she had other options and shifted to falcon form. She screeched and took wing, elevating herself above the rank odor of the grassland.
"Ah," Oberon said. "She says she's finished hunting. Wants to meet us back at the tree where you left your stuff."
"All right, we better go. We can't keep laughing at her expense."
"But it's fun."
"We'll go to Tir na n'Og and visit Govnu. I'll bet he has a snack for you." We began trotting back to the tethered tree as Granuel circled high above.
"Does Govnu have tasty magical appetizers in his pub? Like real buffalo wings instead of chicken wings made in buffalo?"
"No, he doesn't have anything like that. He's one of the three craftsmen, though."
"Sounds like there's a story there."
"Not much of one. They're all sons of Briat, with skills in various arts."
"Uh-oh. Do they have their mother's temper?"
"No, they tend to be jolly lads. Govnu is into smithing and brewing. Lukta is a master woodworker. And Krenya is a master with gold, bronze, or brass."
"So there's no damsel with a tragic history in there? With a name like the Three Craftsmen, they each should build something awesome for a beautiful princess to try to win her favor, and then two of them would die."
"You must be thinking of stories from other cultures. Irish women tend to kick ass and do whatever they want. For exhibits A, B, and C, I give you the Morrigan, Briat, and Flittish."
"Fair enough. So who's the god of cooking among the Tuatha De Danann?"
"I don't think there is one."
"So the ancient Irish had a god of brewing, but not cooking?"
"We had our priorities straight."
"Well then, how do you know Govnu will have a snack for me?"
"He always has something lying about. Pretzels or something to anchor the porter. Allows you to drink more, see? Priorities."
"I'd be more reassured if the priorities had something to do with meat."
We padded in silence for a while after that, which gave me time to consider the implications of vampires converging on us in the Pyrenees. Since I hadn't been actively hunted by vampires, ever, this had to be a result of an order issued by Theophilus. That meant I'd need to eliminate him if I wanted it to stop. That was much more logical than attempting to eliminate all vampires. But even then, his successor might issue the same order. Vampires weren't renowned to be live-and-let-live types. To earn myself a modicum of safety, I'd have to make sure Leif Helgerson was the most powerful vampire in the world. And as soon as I thought of it, I knew that was his plan. By pretending to act in my interest, he was serving his. Just as he did back in Arizona, he was manipulating events so that I'd eliminate his rivals and elevate him to the position he desired. And he knew that if he got to that position, he could safely ignore me, unlike every other vampire in the world. The aid he gave us in Thessalonica, tearing apart those last three dark elves, wasn't an act of generosity or concern, but pure selfishness. I was his ticket to the top, so he couldn't let me die. I could hate him all I wanted for it. He still saw that I needed him and was going to take full advantage of it. And he knew that I wouldn't do anything to him as long as there was a chance he could help me eliminate Theophilus. Granuel was fairly incensed when she landed and shifted back to human. I shifted as well and called up our weapons from their hiding places in the earth.
"That wasn't very nice, Oberon,"
she said, yanking on her clothes with irritation.
I'm sorry. I didn't know it was going to be that bad.
You hoped it would be.
Actually, that was beyond my wildest hopes.
What?
Ugh, that didn't help, buddy.
I mean, I didn't realize how strong your sense of smell would be as a jaguar. I was thinking you'd sneeze a couple of times, and that would be it. The rest of it was funny, but it was never my intention to make you suffer or anything. I'm sorry.
That's better.
Well, I clearly need to adjust if I'm going to be worth a damn in that shape. I'm sure I disgraced every jaguar on the planet today and deserve to be laughed at. But Gaia chose that form for me, so I need to deal with it if I'm going to serve the Earth well. Promise you'll let me try again later?
Sure.
Granuel petted him and looked over at me.
Where to now?
Well, if I'm right, there's a sort of graduation present waiting for you in Tir na n'Og.
An envelope filled with cash and a card signed by all the Tuatha De Danann?
I snorted. No, something a bit more epic. Chapter 23. The proud grin on Govnu's face could have lit up Broadway. He placed a work of art into Granuel's outstretched hands and said,
"This is Skawaje."
Granuel admired it in silence for a few moments, her mouth open and her eyes wide in shock. It was a beautifully wrought staff of oak, carved with knotwork beyond my ken. Lukta, watching her over Govnu's shoulder, asked,
"Why doesn't she say anything?"
"Silence is the perfectest herald of joy," I said.
"Perfectest? Can I get a wooling on this?"
I was quoting Shakespeare, Oberon, therefore it's allowed.
"That guy gets away with everything. Too bad he didn't live long enough to enjoy it. He'd go up to people and say, 'You look like your father, and he had a face like a poxy tit. I'm Shakespeare, so that's allowed.'"
A giggle blurted out of Granuel before she could hold it in, and she blushed.
"Sorry, I was laughing at something the hound said."
Govnu and Lukta nodded in understanding.
"It's wonderful," she added.
And it was. Flush with the wood, the Celtic bindings for strength and speed were carved and inlaid with iron on one end and with silver on the other. The metal was not raised in a ridge or nestled in a valley. It would contact the target at the same time as the wood around it. In this way, the craftsman had created a weapon that would be lethal to fey, bakkens, and werewolves, and the bindings meant the Granuel would enjoy enhanced strength and reflexes while wielding it, even when separated from the earth for a time. It functioned much like my bear charm did. It stored up magic while Granuel was in contact with the earth, and then shared it when she wasn't.
"Unbreakable, of course," Lukta said, "and waterproof.
The iron won't rust, and the silver won't tarnish," Govnu added.
"Amazing," Granuel said. "But what are all these bindings here along the length of the staff? Atticus, do you recognize them?"
"That's actually Flitish's work," Lukta explained. "Or rather, it's my work, but her bindings. They're the reason for the name. Skawaja means shadow staff in modern Irish. Say the proper words and it'll turn ye invisible. True invisibility now, not camouflage. There's some fine print, but I don't know it all. I just carved it according to instructions. You'd best talk to Flitish about it."
Granuel was stunned.
"Flitish did this for me?"
The craftsman nodded.
"Why?"
"Wish I knew the answer to that myself," Govnu said. "She hasn't taught that binding to anyone else, you know."
"Aye, and everyone from Briat to Brownies are begging for it," Lukta said.
"But now you know it, right?"
Granuel pointed to the knots.
"Nope, she's got all kinds of stuff going on there. I don't know which part of it is invisibility and which is pure decoration. I imagine it all accomplishes something, but these aren't standard bindings. They're unique. Ye have something truly special there."
Granuel remembered not to thank them directly.
"You do me great honor. I will do my best to live up to it."
"Atta girl,"
Lucta said.
"Shall we have a drink to celebrate?" Govnu asked. "I happen to bring a few bottles along."
We were at Lukta's studio, one of the most pleasant workspaces I have ever visited. Sawdust on the floor, milled wood stacked against one wall along the shelves of burls and knots and branches, and polished, finished pieces resting against another. We were near the workbenches, where lathes and chisels and peelers awaited the attention of Lukta's expert hands. The smells of pine and cedar and aged oak filled the space, and these were much more agreeable to everyone's nose than rhino shit. We had made a brief stop at Mananon MacLear's estate to clean up and get a fresh set of clothes. We looked more old-fashioned Irish now than modern American, wearing tunics and pants in his blue-gray color palette. Mananon gave Granuel a silver belt of cockle shells and seahorses as a sort of graduation gift, and made much ado about the strength of her animal forms. Fand gave her some silvery hair clip thingies and some cookies that may have been magical. Oberon and I got ignored. They didn't remember I was there until I said we had to get going to Lukta's. Granuel had her hair all brushed out and shining with silver bits, and I wasn't the only person at Lukta's shop to think she looked like a goddess. A large shadow darkened the doorway, and a deep voice called,
"Flidish, you are even more fetching than usual today."
Granuel turned toward the voice and discovered Ogma there, who blanched once he realized his mistake.
"Oh, I beg your pardon," he said, a flush coloring his cheeks. "I meant no offense."
"No offense taken, sir,"
Granuel said, casting her eyes sideways at me with a tiny wink.
"There are worse fates than to be mistaken for a renowned beauty."
Ogma smiled.
"I see you are now bound to the earth. Congratulations. And you have a new weapon. Congratulations on that, also. Are you anxious to try it out?"
"I am, actually," Granuel replied, casting an admiring glance at Skawaja.
"Shall we have a friendly sparring match, then?"
"How friendly?"
"Say, 2 falls out of 3. Winner takes clothing."
Granuel raised an eyebrow and replied,
"Done,"
before I could counsel her not to. Ogma was a famed champion of the Tuatha De Danann, brother to the Dada, half-brother to Lu, and grandfather of the Three Craftsmen. He used to take care of the king's problems. The rumors of his demise in some tales were greatly exaggerated. He was too much of a badass to die. Nuada Silverhand, the old king of the Tuatha De Danann, used to point at this unbeatable monster or that unstoppable atrocity and tell Ogma to wreck it, and it would be wrecked. One day he said, "Damn it, Ogma, the Irish need a writing system," and Ogma came up with Ogham script. Granuel probably knew all this, however, and had decided to accept anyway. The time for me to offer unsolicited advice was over. Ogma, again dressed only in a kilt, muscles rippling with every movement, asked Lukta if he could borrow a staff. He was much taller than anyone, and his reach far exceeded Granuel's. Granuel moved to the far side of the workshop, choosing her spot in the sawdust. She twirled it about experimentally, getting used to its weight and length. These twirls gradually grew faster, until the staff blurred like a propeller blade. Ogma stepped through some of his own warm-up exercises, twirling his staff in one hand at such speeds that Granuel's hair was blown back a bit. He wasn't one to be psyched out. Well, not with words, anyway. As part of Granuel's training in martial arts, I taught her to take advantage of men's weaknesses prior to the first strike. If her opponent was a patriarchal, misogynist asshole, she could taunt him into a rash attack by the simple expedient of calling him a bitch. The same man could be set off his guard by feigned displays of fear. Ogma wasn't that type, and indeed it would have been difficult to find any of that sort amongst the Tuatha De Danann, who had comfortably accepted Briid's dominance for centuries. If her opponent was a younger, inexperienced man, or perhaps unattractive, Loud speculation about the diminutive size of his penis would take him out of the cool, quiet place required for martial discipline. Ogma wasn't that guy either. Ogma was the third kind of guy, like me, who would find Granuel's skill not uppity or challenging, but rather madly attractive. As long as Ogma didn't check her out in the magical spectrum and discover that Granuel and I were bound together rather tightly, some part of his brain, perhaps a large part, would fantasize about seducing her, and he wouldn't want to hurt her because of it. Granuel's job was to make him think he had a chance. So she smiled at him. She complimented him on his earrings, and then on his six-pack, and stared pointedly at his kilt while she waited for him to respond.
"Thank you," he said, smiling.
"Begin,"
Granuel replied, and then she spun and leapt twice to add gravity and centrifugal force to her first blow, aimed at his head. It was an aggressive attack, perhaps too aggressive. Ogma met it with his staff held crosswise, and once Skawaja rebounded, he extended his arms to knock it back again, preventing a graceful redirection. She was on the defensive now and off balance. Ogma took long strides, lunging with his staff and forcing Granuel into a series of desperate parries. Mananon Meclear's instruction about the political situation in Tir na n'og burst through the door of my frontal lobe and plopped itself down on the couch. Ogma was definitely on Briat's side, and if he, however erroneously, thought Granuel was in the Morrigan's camp, this friendly sparring match might not be so friendly. Could Ogma be behind the attacks on us? He certainly had the connections to pursue us if he wished. I almost dismissed the thought because it didn't jibe with the perfectly civil and generous behavior of his grandsons, Lukta and Govnu. If anyone was on Briat's side, it was them, and yet they'd been nothing but kind to us. Still, Ogma could have his own agenda, independent of theirs. There was no monolithic thought police in Tir na n'og, and nothing was what it seemed. Even combat. Granuel anticipated a strike and caught it as it was still coming up. She had the leverage and should have been able to force Ogma's staff down, since she was already over the top. Instead, Ogma's upswing halted and held. He was too strong to be driven down, despite his disadvantage. She lifted and whipped her staff to whack at his head, when the smarter move would have been to shift down and sweep at his legs. He was pretty firmly set, however, his balance impeccable, so perhaps the wild strike at his head was the slightly wiser move to rattle him. It would certainly have rattled him had it connected. However, Ogma leaned back and turned his cheek, avoiding the blow while extending his arms and striking down with his staff. It cracked painfully against Granuel's kneecap. It numbed her for a second, and that was all Ogma needed. He pushed. She was off balance and couldn't keep up with the flurry of strikes he unleashed, and he was able to sneak past her guard and buckle her knees from behind. She knew she was going down and shouted, "Damn it!" as she fell.
"Ha! Excellent!"
Ogma grinned.
"You have been well trained."
He shot out his hand to help her up, and Granuel glowered at him. I smiled, recognizing that expression. Oberon recognized it too.
"Oh, now he's done it. Did you see that, Atticus? He's doomed. There's an anvil falling from the sky to crush him, and he has no clue."
"Yes, I saw it," I said. "But careful what you say here. Remember, people can hear you." Lukta and Govnu had cast a couple of amused glances at Oberon when he'd spoken up, but thankfully Ogma hadn't been tuning in. I'm not sure if Ogma's patronizing tone had been intentional or not, whether he had meant to goad her in other words, but regardless, Granuel was well and truly goaded. She had a fascinating tendency to access another level of ability when she was angry. Not rage-fueled barbarism, but rather a hyper-awareness and clarity that one needs for combat. I had tried to make her access it without the emotion, because the very peak of her abilities should not be dependent on such, but I'd failed miserably. Emotion could motivate her like nothing else. Her long-simmering anger at her stepfather had pushed her to become a druid in the first place. She was squaring off for round two when Flittish entered the shop. She had abandoned her court apparel and returned to the greens and browns of her leathers.
"What is this?" she asked. "A contest?"
"A friendly one,"
Ogma answered. Grognuail did not affirm this. Perrin lumbered in behind Flittish. He looked pleasantly exhausted, and he had found a tailor somewhere to fashion him a new set of clothes. Apparently Perrin had given instructions that his abundant chest hair should be displayed to best advantage, for it was, bursting forth in coppery curls from a deeply cut V-neck tunic of walnut brown.
"Contest is good," he said. "I like to see."
He sauntered in my general direction, pulling out a flask of vodka from his belt as he did so. Flittish raised a hand.
"A moment, if you will, Ogma. Our newest druid is likely unfamiliar with how her weapon works."
"She is familiar,"
he assured her.
"She is quite skilled."
He smiled again, and Grognuail scowled. She wasn't trying to flirt with him anymore.
"He's making it worse."
"I know. It's great."
"You won't give her any unfair advantage," Ogma said. "My staff has no bindings, it's just wood."
This drew a few chuckles, and Flittish elicited a few more when she said,
"We know, Ogma."
Flittish reassured Ogma that Grognuail wouldn't turn invisible or anything like that, and it would just be a moment, and he relaxed. Seeing Flittish speak in hushed tones to Grognuail, however, I tensed up. Flittish was most definitely on Briett's side of politics. If anything, she was much more Briett's right hand than Ogma or anyone else. I could never forget that when Angus Ogg was out to get me, it was Flittish who kidnapped Oberon to force me to confront the God of Love directly. She had done so at Briett's command. She was also the one who had convinced me to accept the exploded Lord Grundlebeard theory. And, I realized with a chill, she might also be the one speaking to vampires. Two events, months apart, that I had not connected until now. Flittish leaping out of my bed, ready to fight because I consorted with a vampire named Leif Helgerson, and then Leif Helgerson, on a cold stretch of Siberian tundra, telling me that it was Flittish who had suggested to him centuries ago that he wait for me in some desert, and eventually I would flee there in my attempt to hide from Angus Ogg and the Fae. One of them had lied to me about knowing the other. On the one hand, it was far more likely that Flittish would unbind a vampire on sight than give him advice on how to find the world's last druid. But then again, if Flittish was truly on speaking terms with vampires, she might do much to hide the fact. She might even give my apprentice an enchanted weapon with bindings no one else could properly read. That made me wonder. What else was carved into the grain of Grognuail's staff besides a spell for invisibility? Was there a way to trace her, perhaps? A dinner bell for vampires? I know it is rude to question gifts, but this might be of the Trojan horse variety. Even if it were legit, invisibility would not be the devastating advantage that it would be against humans. Vampires could use their other senses to track her movements reliably. Conspiracies are fun, I've noticed, only when you're the one conspiring. Or if you're one of those guys who live in trailers and believe the government is hiding aliens. They must have fun fantasizing about how badly the nation is being deceived. But to know, for certain, that you are the target of a conspiracy, that's not entertaining. It's a recipe for acid reflux. I need a Tums.
That's not how you spell relief, Atticus.
It was high time that I did some conspiring of my own. I called to Govnu and asked if we could have a quick word. The brewer grinned in good spirits and offered one of those greetings where you grip forearms instead of hands.
"What's on your mind, most ancient druid?"
"Can you make one of those cone of silence thingies so we can't be overheard?" I asked. I never quite learned that trick.
"Sure," Govnu said. "You kind of have to learn it if you're going to have a serious talk in Tiernan Oak. Fairies everywhere."
He mumbled a few words in Old Irish and rolled his eyes up, and it was done. It was less graceful than the way Monanon had done it, and I didn't quite catch all the words.
"There,"
he said. I'll teach it to you later if you like. Thanks. What's the coin of the realm in Tir na n'og these days?
Gold and silver are still acceptable everywhere.
Excellent. I was wondering if you had any pods of human frequenting your pub.
Human?
Govnu's affable expression disappeared.
Who are you wanting to kill, Atticus?
I shrugged. No one important here, just some vampires on Earth. Govnu frowned.
That battle was fought long ago, Atticus, and the druids lost.
I didn't lose. I just took a very long time out. The vampires are after me now. Grognuail, too. I'm not going to sit back and let them call all the shots this time. I have resources now. The Fae have resources, and we should use them. Govnu considered this and nodded once.
All right, but why human?
Vampires can't sense them. No heartbeats. No blood. But the human do have magical sight, so they can see a vampire's aura and figure out where to stick them. Pun intended. They're made of wood, so duh, a quick branch through the chest and we're done. Cut off the head, bring it to you for bounty, keep a tab running, I'll pay monthly.
Whoa, bring the heads to me, and a tab?
Why not?
Because I don't want to be involved when the vampires start wondering who's offing them. They can reach us here, you know. They have contacts, and they can hire human or anyone else.
Do you know who their contacts are?
No.
Well, I'm sure you have contacts too, and can conduct business as cleverly as they can. Don't you have a barfly who conducts such shady doings anyway?
Yes,
he admitted. Employ him, then. Govnu shook his head.
You're asking me to start a war?
No, it's already started. I'm asking you to help me win it. And honestly, it doesn't have to be human only. It could be a standing bounty for anyone seeking fortune. Let the vampires relearn what it feels like to be hunted again. They have had their own way for far too long.
Any vampires okay?
Yes, as long as it's from Italy. Start with Rome and spread out from there. Follow the path of the Roman conquest, in fact. That will take out the oldest vampires first, and the hunting will get easier as you go. Theophilus was in Greece presently, but so was Leif. I didn't quite want him dead yet, in case he proved useful. The world's vampires marched to orders from Rome, however, and it was time to hit them where it would hurt most. Theophilus would probably have to move to Italy to take over personally if the human were successful.
How do we know a vampire's head is from Italy?
Govnu asked. Have them document the proceedings with a cell phone camera equipped with GPS.
You know they'll just make new vampires to replace the ones they lost.
I know, but they'll be younger, weaker, stupider, and unclear on why druids should be feared and hunted if it's a bunch of wee fairies killing them. Govnu's face split in a wide grin, and he laughed.
It's been a merry few months around here, now that you're back. No one could call you tedious.
We spoke for a few moments more on bounties and such, and during this time Flitish completed her instructions to Grognuail. I was well pleased and looking forward to the results of my little chat with Govnu. When Leif had supposedly died after the Thor business, the news caused vampires from all over the world to fight one another for the right to rule a piece of his territory. Freeing up territory in Rome itself would cause the world's vampires to flail like Muppets in their eagerness to be the next bloodsuckers in chief. And in their wakes, other, smaller power vacuums would open up and consume even more of them. Hunting two druids would cease to be important. Mwahaha! When Ogma and Grognuail set themselves for the second round, I could tell she would win it by following her eyes. She was watching her opponent. She would play the defensive, letting him commit, and then she'd counterattack. Decisively. I'd been on the receiving end of it too many times to count. Ogma was watching his opponent as well, but in the wrong way. He was admiring Grognuail's legs and the curve of her breasts, already anticipating what he'd see once he won her clothes. An arrogance had crept into his manner, an overconfidence, and he didn't see that the second round would be much different from the first. Once it began, Ogma was on the ground in less than 30 seconds, much to the astonishment of everyone but Oberon and me. Grognuail thrust out her hand in his face and said,
"Excellent. You are well trained.
The workshop quieted. To have a new druid, scarcely into her third decade, speak to a god centuries old like that? Throwing his own words back at him? I was so proud. Ogma, to his credit, did not take offense. He rose without her help, dusted off his kilt, and grinned ruefully.
Okay, I deserved that.
He should have apologized. It would have cooled her down, and she would have lost focus. She'd pay attention to the fact that she was sparring with a legend and was being watched by gods. But his admission of guilt without apology kept her focused. The third round was intense, and much longer. It was an outstanding showcase of skill from both combatants. Grognewail wanted to win, and against almost any other opponent she would have. But Ogma was roused now, and he did, after all, have centuries more experience than she. When Ogma finally got through her defense and dropped her for the second time, he was clearly sweating, and his face showed relief. The applause was loud. Thunderous, even, thanks to Perrin clapping next to me.
I am liking your peoples more all the times,
he bellowed over the noise. Once it had died down, Ogma leered at Grognewail and said,
Your clothes, please.
Certainly,
she replied, then disappeared. A few confused noises filled the workshop, then laughter, as everyone realized that she had activated the enchantment on her staff.
Atticus, will you come hold this for me, please?
Her voice called. Sure. I walked toward the place where she had been standing and stopped when her hand grabbed my shirt. She pulled me close and then guided my hand to Skawaja. Once I touched it, I could see her.
I'm invisible to them right now, aren't I?
She whispered.
Yes, we both should be now.
Let me try something. Hold this against my belly.
She raised her tunic. I touched her belly with the staff, and she let go with her hands.
How about now?
I checked with Oberon. Can you see us?
Nope.
Okay, Grognewail said. Keep it there.
She quickly took off her clothes, always keeping contact with the staff, and tossed her tunic and pants toward Ogma. They became visible as soon as they left her hand. There was much laughter at Ogma's disappointed face. I saw that this could not have turned out any better. Though Ogma had technically won, Grognewail had lost nothing and had, in a sense, outmaneuvered him. And no one would patronize her after this. A familiar fairy in Briat's livery appeared in the doorway to the shop and cleared his throat pompously. Recognizing the herald, everyone stopped and stared at him. His voice, like a foghorn, projected certain doom.
All of the Tuatha De Danann are called to the court immediately to hear a message from the Olympians.
Lucta frowned at the herald.
From the Greeks or the Romans?
From both. Hermes and Mercury have come together to deliver the message.
Grognewail tilted her head toward me and whispered,
How did they get here?
As messengers of the gods, they have the ability to walk the plains like we do, I explained, just not in the same way.
Any idea what they're on about?
Govnu asked the herald. The fairy coughed softly into his fist and paused, as if considering his answer deeply.
While I cannot say for sure, my speculation would be that it has something to do with the Iron Druid.
Several heads started to turn in our direction, but they caught themselves and none spoke a word about our silent, invisible presence.
We'd best go then, Ogma said.
Everyone nodded and murmured agreement and began to file out of the shop. Grognewail and I followed. We asked Oberon to wait for us in the workshop. I gave her my tunic so that she'd be covered up in case we were forced to show ourselves, but I fully intended to behave like the proverbial fly on the wall, the one that always gets away and never gets swatted. When we got to the great wide meadow of the Fey Court, Grognewail found it interesting that there were far fewer Fey assembled to witness the audience of the Olympians. There were hardly any, in fact, aside from the assembled lords, and even they were not fully in attendance. All the Tuatha De Danann appeared, however, shifting themselves on short notice to the court on Briet's command. The Olympian messenger gods floated 3 feet above the ground, perhaps 10 yards from the small hillock on which sat Briet's throne. She was dressed far more formally for this occasion, draped in flat silken panels of royal and powder blue. She affected boredom as she waited for the Tuatha De Danann to assemble. When all seats had been filled, she turned her head to the gods in a dilatory manner and said,
"All are present. You may proceed, sirs."
There are teachers out there who like to tell their students that the only difference between the Greek and the Roman gods is their names. This is patently untrue. Apart from the wings on their ankles, Hermes and Mercury have very little in common. And the same is true of every Olympian pair. The Greeks and Romans were different people, after all, and imagined their gods differently. Hermes lacked body fat to a rather indiscreet degree, and I desperately wanted to lob a cheeseburger in his general direction to see if he'd let it fall. There were ribs and veins showing, and some of the veins also appeared to have whipcord muscles of their own. His eyes were red-rimmed, haunted, and supported by baggage that wouldn't fit easily in the overhead bin, but they were fixed professionally on Briet's defenses, unless I missed my guess. If the shit went down, Hermes would be ready. His hands were large, with square-cut, chunky fingers, like those in Frank Miller sketches, and his bare feet were also oversized. He had the skin tone of a mime, and spoke like one, too. That is, he let Mercury do all the talking. He held his caduceus in his right hand as if ready to brain someone with it. Mercury looked as if he'd just been shat out of a Milanese day spa. In modern popular imagination, his was the silhouette that delivered flowers quickly to your loved ones. Bronze skin and whitened teeth made me suspect abnormally high levels of asshattery. His feet were sandaled, and he steepled his fingers together in front of his stomach before he spoke.
"The gods Pan and Faunus, and the goddesses Artemis and Diana, demand the immediate return of the dryads kidnapped from the slopes of Mount Olympus."
Holy shit. I'd thought that Briet's herald was pompous, but Mercury was schooling him on that with every word. Oil and contempt practically dripped from his lips.
"If they are harmed," Mercury continued, "the life of the druid Sheohan O'Sullivan is forfeit, and blood price will be required of the Tuatha De Danann for not controlling him. His life may be forfeit anyway," he added, "because the god Bacchus has sworn to slay him."
"Your gods and goddesses address their suit to the wrong party," Briet replied, "for we are not the druid of whom you speak, nor do we have any control over him. He is not our subject, and we cannot be held responsible for his actions."
She turned to her assembled kin.
"Do any of you have any knowledge whatsoever about these kidnapped dryads?"
She let the silence linger for the space of 10 heartbeats, then regarded the Olympians again.
"There is your answer."
"We hear you and will deliver your message even so to Olympus."
"Before you go, a question," Briet said. "In case I am able to contact the druid, is there any guarantee of his safe conduct if he returns the dryads?"
The Olympians exchanged a glance, and Hermes gave Mercury the barest of nods.
"He will be safe from all save Bacchus if he returns the dryads within the night," Mercury said.
Hermes finally chose to speak after all. His voice was a melodic aria struggling to break free of base speech, as if someone had shoved a wee creative genius into a gray suit and a grayer cubicle and told him to just fucking stay there forever. It was odd how the impeccably groomed Mercury could say hello and inspire visions of a quick strike to the sack. Yet when Hermes spoke, the much rougher looking of the pair, it was beautiful and sad, and I wanted to buy him a beer so I could help him weep into it.
"All the members of my pantheon are willing to forgive the trespass if the dryads are returned immediately," he said.
Well, that was it for me. I wanted to return the dryads immediately. So did Granuaile.
Atticus, let's go,
she whispered.
Yeah, let's.
We turned our backs on the court as Briad exchanged farewells with the Olympian messengers. We had a mission. The faster we do this, the better off we'll be, I said to Granuaile once we were out of earshot. While all the Olympians wait around for Hermes and Mercury to talk things over and send messages back and forth, we'll get this done.
I'm all for it, Granuaile said, but I'd like a fresh set of clothes first.
Oh, right. We returned first to the workshop to pick up Oberon. Then we shifted to a safe house of sorts in the Uncompahgre wilderness in southwestern Colorado. It was a cabin located near the old Camp Bird mine, some 10 miles west of Ouray, and I had bought it under an alias 6 years ago to conduct some business with Odin. Surrounded by a forest tethered to Tir na n'Og, it was an ideal rendezvous point and a place to store changes of clothes for times like these. It was also out of Coyote's territory and a safe place for Oberon to spend some time by himself if necessary, since it was equipped with a large doggy door and plenty of food and water, not to mention squirrels and deer galore. Granuaile and I changed clothes quickly and told Oberon he'd be on his own for a while.
How long?
Hopefully only a few hours. Less than 3 months. You were terrible with time anyway. Now listen. You are absolutely forbidden to go into any mine shafts around here. They're off limits, you understand? If a squirrel runs inside, you count him dead. You don't go after him. And you don't get to pretend that they are bat caves either. You can't save Gotham from here.
Okay, I remember the rules.
Have fun hunting, buddy. I petted him, and he wagged his tail. Granuaile finished strapping on a replacement set of throwing knives and kissed his head.
I hope we'll get to go hunting with you soon, she said.
Yeah, maybe we'll try for caribou. There are fewer pungent aromas in the tundra.
That's very considerate of you, she said, smiling.
Hey, will you put in disc 2 of the Fellowship of the Wing before you go? I need a refresher on the Mines of Moria.
Chapter 24. We shifted to the first dryad's tree in Olympus and cautiously scanned the area. Seeing no one, I opened a portal to the island of Slow Time with the admonition to Granuaile that she should watch. I'm going to have you do the later ones.
Okay. Why don't we just open portals wherever we want?
You can't open them at all if you're not in an area that's been bound to Tir na n'Og. But we avoid them because it takes longer to open one and uses far more energy. We shift via trees because it requires the least amount of the Earth's power. That's why Angus Og's huge portal to Hell drained the Earth and killed it. Parts of the dead land around Tony Cabin were functioning on a basic level again, but large patches were still dead, and it had taken us years of toil to bring it back even to weak levels of life. The first dryad we'd separated from her tree stared uncertainly back at us, suspended in midair a few feet above the ground of the Time Island. Her arms were splayed out toward us in a final, desperate bid to grab hold of this plane. I held onto Granuaile's left hand and told her to reach through and pull the dryad back with her other.
I don't need some kind of long pole or something?
No. As long as half of you stays here, you won't get pulled into that time stream.
What about pulling her out, though? Won't that cause whiplash or something?
No. In that time stream, she's only begun to fall. Gravity just figured out she's in the air above the island, but she hasn't even had a full second to fall 5 yards or so. Look at her. She's hardly moved, and it's been almost 2 months for us. So yanking her back right now would be no worse than one of those tango moves where you extend your arm and then pull your partner back to you. Grab her gently. Remember, to her, we're a blur in the sky.
All right.
Granuaile reached through the portal and took her time wrapping her fingers around the dryad's wrist.
Ready?
Yep. Do it. Granuaile pulled. The dryad found her feet on solid ground again, then reeled as soon as Granuaile let her go. The dryad blinked and sat down heavily underneath the canopy of her tree.
What happened? My head spins.
Sorry about that, I said in Latin.
She peered at me and her eyes widened.
Your face, wasn't half of it scarred and melted a moment ago?
She noticed that Grognewail looked different too.
And now you have strange markings on your arm. What magic is this?
It is the magic of the earth and of the Fae, I replied. I apologize for the inconvenience and whatever pain you might have felt. I was forced to use you to get the attention of Faunus. He wasn't allowing me to bind my apprentice to the earth, you see, but all is well now, or will be shortly. I'm going to mend the broken bonds with your tree.
How?
The same way I unbound them, except backward. Are you capable of seeing your bond with the tree?
No, I just feel it.
Please tell me if you feel better, then. This shouldn't take long. Grognewail offered to help the dryad to her feet, but she shied away.
No, thank you,
the dryad said.
I'll manage by myself.
Okay, Grognewail said, backing away with a friendly grin on her face. She continued chatting and apologizing while I turned my attention to the magical spectrum and sought to restore order to the small bit of chaos I'd brought to the tree's binding with the dryad. It took a little longer than unbinding, for creation is always more difficult than destruction, but it wasn't like visiting a modern doctor's office either, where patients must learn the true meaning of patience before they can get treated. The dryad admitted she felt whole again once I was finished. Excellent. Again, I'm sorry for the necessity, but I'm very relieved we could restore you completely. We have to perform this same operation on 5 more of your sisters and need the time and space to do it in. If you would refrain from calling to Faunus or any other god for 2 hours, that would give us sufficient time to rebind all dryads to their trees without interference, and then, when everyone's safe, you can call to Faunus and receive an enthusiastic welcome back, which will no doubt include several erotic terms for which the Latin language is still renowned today. The dryad's jaw dropped. Grognewail flashed her a Spock salute and wished her long life and prosperity.
Who are you?
The dryad asked.
I'm so confused.
I've had many names throughout the centuries, I began, but Grognewail was reminded of one in particular and jumped in.
In Toronto, they call him Nigel, she said.
You never want to be a Nigel in Toronto, I told her. Trust me.
I don't know where Toronto is,
the dryad said, looking lost. It's a place across the ocean with a great film festival and a bad hockey team, I explained, but she still looked bewildered. Their ticket prices are sky high, but they haven't hefted the Stanley Cup since 1967. I know there's always next year, but damn, you know? None of this helped. The dryad looked ready to go fetal, so I thought it best to leave her alone and move on to the next one. I gestured to Grognewail, and we shifted to the next dryad's tree and repeated the procedure. We tried to keep the chit-chat to a minimum, but were unfailingly polite and very apologetic. I let Grognewail do the last two, portal and all. She left the portals open while she was binding the dryads back to their trees, but I'd speak to her about it later. The last dryad was a bit more miffed at us than the others, who had been more bemused than anything else. She wasn't afraid of us, and neither was she above threatening us a little bit. After I finished mending her bond to her oak, she said,
"You'll suffer as no mortal has suffered in an age."
"But I fixed everything," I protested.
"It was arrogance from beginning to end,"
she replied, slipping into her tree. Her voice changed once she was inside.
"Suffer,"
she said. Or rather, the leaves seemed to say it, no more than a husky whisper and a rustle on a windless day. I looked at Grognewail and she shrugged.
"It's done,"
she said in English. I don't know. That was weird. You'd think that she'd be nicer to us since I've already demonstrated that I can destroy her bond to the oak.
"It's because she has friends here,"
a voice said from behind. Grognewail and I turned around and saw no one at first. But then a large group of women draped in white shimmered into view, with a single smirking figure in the center of them.
"I swore I'd tear you apart with my own hands, druid," Bacchus said. I may be mad, but I tend to remember things like that.
Chapter 25. Usually, I treasure new experiences. I still remember my very first snow cone, for example. It was highly artificial raspberry and turned my tongue blue. My first time in Madagascar was awesome because lemurs are kind of funny. They throw fruit at the back of your head when you're not looking, and then point at one another when you turn around. But there are times when you don't appreciate novelty, such as when you're trying to run for your life, and this was one of those times. I couldn't shift away from Bacchus because the damn tree slapped my hand away every time I tried to touch it, thanks to the dryad inside. New experience, but not cool.
Should we go invisible?
Granuel asked. No, they'd smell the magic and chase us.
The man is mine,
Bacchus said to his horde of maenads.
But you can entertain yourselves with the woman.
And then he charged me with all the confidence of the truly immortal. Don't grapple, I advised Granuel quickly. Keep them at a distance. They're stronger than you are, but not as quick. It might have been better to advise her to run, but she was already moving toward them. There were close to 100 of them, and only one of her, but since the Bacchants were half-stupid with liquor and secure in their numbers, they had difficulty processing the fact that Granuel was attacking them. Nor would they be immune to wood. I caught a flash of her lunging forward and flipping Skawaja down hard on a skull just to set the proper tone. The Bacchant crumpled, and Granuel sprang away, content now to lead the drunken savages on a merry chase. I loved how she always struck first when threatened. She appreciated the value of surprise and wielded it with often deadly results. I didn't get to watch her much after that. Bacchus was in my face. Like his followers, he was immune to iron, so Fragora was useless, and I left it in its sheath. We had never tangled personally, and I'd rather hoped we never would. But I'd seen him fight before against Leaf, and he wasn't terribly skilled, just terribly strong. I leapt about 8 feet straight up, and he bull-rushed headfirst into the dryad's tree, which cracked and groaned.
"Outwatch it,"
the dryad said. I tucked my legs underneath me for the leap, but kicked out with my right as I fell, to take advantage of Bacchus's rebound. He took it on the chin and flopped backward after staggering a couple of paces. His skin was changing before my eyes. The baby-faced libertine was being replaced by the wine-mad monster. Where a soft blue tracery of veins might show beneath a pink blush of skin in his contentment, now they throbbed green and stood out like vines, and the whites of his eyes flooded with a deep burgundy. If he got hold of me, I'd be in trouble. Goading him would work in my favor, though, since he would lose even more discipline the crazier he got. And since I knew exactly what kind of guy he was, I employed the advice I'd given to Granuel and said, "Come on, bitch! Charge me again and see what happens." He lost his mind completely after that. He purpled and drooled as he roared and gave not a single shit about it. He rose and quivered and just yelled inchoately in a roid rage until his lungs gave out. I bore this display with patience and used the time to figure out how to beat him. Unlike the Norse or the Tuatha De Danann, or me, the bloody Olympians couldn't be killed. They could be harmed, but they could heal from anything. Even if they were disintegrated or blown to tiny bits, they simply regenerated on Olympus and put on a fresh toga. There had to be a solution to him, or else the Morrigan would be here fighting him for me, fulfilling her oath. The best solution would be to run and use some other tree to shift away. In fact, I hoped Granuel would do exactly that. But the cries of pain I heard in the forest weren't hers. In battle, as in charity, it is better to give than to receive. Bacchus finished emoting and charged me again. I crouched, ready to jump, and then it was a simple matter to fake the leap and watch Bacchus launch himself over my head. His face met the tree for the second time, and while he was in the air above me, I punched him in the groin as hard as I could. In my mind's eye, he was supposed to curl up and cradle his crushed grapes, but that's not what happened. It toppled him so that he fell headfirst down my back, and he grabbed clumsily at my legs as he hit the ground. It wasn't a move or a punch or anything more than a desperate flail on his part, but it knocked me off my feet and sent me sprawling. Before I could scramble away, he managed to clap a hand around my ankle and haul me toward him. I twisted around and aimed a kick at his head. It rocked his neck back and he lost teeth, but he shook it off and grinned bloodily.
No, you're not getting away now that I have you.
He aimed a vengeful punch at my groin, but I turned in time to take it on the thigh instead. That would be a nice bruise. I kicked him in the face again, and the fucker laughed. Apparently, he could turn off pain much like I could, but unlike me, he found physical punishment amusing. I tried to make him laugh harder by kicking him some more. Bacchus tired of it after all, and slapped my leg down on the next kick, then leapfrogged on top of my knees, pinning them. I bucked, crunched up, and landed a solid blow on his temple, but this failed to dislodge him. He grabbed my shoulders and slammed me back to the ground. Against a normal opponent, that would have been a stupid move because I could still deliver rib-cracking blows to his body, but Bacchus simply didn't care. He wanted to taunt me, and he was saying something in Latin, but I ignored this and crafted a binding in Old Irish between his toga and the dryad's tree. The binding worked, but this also failed to dislodge Bacchus. He lunged forward, bore down, and let the toga tear away from him rather than let me go. His strength was such that I began to doubt I could match him. I reached for power, felt that it was abnormally low, and remembered that Granuel had left the portal open. I was going to need her help to get out of this, though she might very well be thinking she'd need my help to escape the Bakkens at this point. I shouted for help in Russian and added that she should break the wine god's elbow. I kept shouting it in a loop.
"What is it you say?"
Bacchus said.
"Some pithy insult?"
His fingers dug into my shoulders painfully until his thumbs ground into bone. My blows were having no effect. He merely pushed down on my right shoulder and began to pull on my left one, and soon enough he had torn my arm loose from its socket. He kept pulling. He really did mean to tear me apart limb from limb. He never saw what hit him, and neither did I. But I saw, and he definitely felt, his left arm bending the wrong way, heard the crack and tearing of tissue, marveled at the white bone splinters shredding the inside of his arm. He collapsed on top of me in shock, and I was finally able to dislodge him. A few Bakkens trailed by, seeking an invisible Granuel. I got to my feet and put a bit of distance between Bacchus and me. We both had useless left arms, but only one of us now had a clear plan of how to proceed. Bacchus was howling over his shredded arm and spurting what passed for blood among the Olympians. Ichor, I think they called it. He'd heal up far faster than I would with a similar injury, but he was seriously jacked up for the present and kneeling only 10 feet or so in front of the still open portal. He'd probably never even seen it, since he'd originally approached me perpendicular to it. I walked toward him coolly, right side first, and he staggered to his feet once he saw this. He backed up as he did so, putting himself closer to the portal. Bakken streamed between us, still pursuing Granuel, mindlessly obeying the last order they were given when they could have easily taken me out. Bacchus roared and waved me forward with his right hand, daring me to charge. I chose my spot carefully, waiting for two Bakkens to pass between us before I shot toward him with juice speed and planted a swift kick to his chest. He tried to grab my foot with his right hand, but he wasn't quick enough. He staggered back and through the portal, realizing too late that there was no ground underneath him anymore. I grinned as I closed the portal on his bellow of rage. "It's going to take him 1,000 years to finish falling on his ass," I said. Chapter 26. Abruptly cut off from Bacchus, the Maenads stopped caring about Granuel and began wondering where the hell they were and why they were wearing white nighties.
"Oh my god, what happened to your teeth?" one said.
"My teeth?
What's up with yours? My teeth are fine. Wait.
She put fingers with torn nails up to her lips and discovered she had a mouthful of fangs.
Oh, Jesus, they're all pointy and shit.
The screams, once they began, were contagious. Part of it was the terror of sheer confusion. Part of it was the terror at their future dental bills. I actually was happy for them. We discovered a way to free them from their thrall, and they could be human again. Granuel appeared, Skawaja in hand, and looked worried about my dangling left arm. Yes, you do get to shove it back in, I said.
I was afraid of that,
she said. Thanks for the assist. Normally I would chew you out for leaving open a portal that long, but this time I'll let it slide. She grinned and gave me a quick kiss.
Thanks.
Letting an amateur shove your arm back into its socket is unpleasant. But when you have magic at your disposal, it's better than getting insurance and waiting 5 hours for a professional to do it. Jogging north together until we found a tethered tree without an annoyed dryad inside, we shifted to our cabin near Camp Birdmine to greet our happy hound.
Great news, Atticus,
Oberon said as he bounded toward us, fresh from getting a drink in the Uncompahgre River.
I have independently verified that there are no Balrogs in this mine, and no goblins or cave trolls either, only rats. I don't know what they're eating, though. It makes you wonder about those rats in First Blood, remember them? They were hanging out, no visible nests, just waiting deep in this abandoned mine for a tortured Vietnam veteran to pass by in his attempt to escape a brutal small-town sheriff with the ability to boss around the state police and the National Guard.
Oberon, did you go into the mine?
No, I just listened at the entrance and sniffed around a bit, honest.
Oberon?
Okay, I might have set foot across the threshold. I was only trying to ditch those two ravens.
What two ravens?
The two that have been following me around for a while now. See them on the roof over there?
Casting my eyes toward the mine foreman's house, I saw the ravens he was talking about. They weren't the normal kind. They were a bit bigger than usual, and each had one eye that gleamed white. That's Hugin and Moonin, I said. Granuel tensed.
Odin's ravens?
Yep. She began to scan the area.
He's here somewhere?
I doubt it. He won't get within striking distance of me again if he can help it. He probably has backup ravens and everything. I bet this is a call to arms from Frigg. She'll be wanting me to kill Fenris now that you're bound to the earth, but stay on your guard in case I'm wrong. We began walking toward the foreman's house, our eyes never resting but searching for threats. None appeared, though Hugin and Moonin did their best to serve us up some turbo-grim memento mori action. As we neared the front porch, Frigg floated from the backyard to meet us. She was wearing another of her Dalek dresses, but this one was blue and green with white swirls reminiscent of marshmallows melting in chocolate. She smiled and greeted us, the very picture of hospitality, her sour expression from months ago now gone. An arm appeared from underneath her hair and waved gracefully at the door to the abandoned house.
Shall we go in?
I winced. It's probably not a good idea, I said. It's been vacant for years, and the last time I was in there, it was full of rodent droppings.
Oh, I am well aware, but that is no longer true.
She lowered her voice conspiratorially.
A dwarf owed me a favor, and I permitted him to clean the place for our use. He has been very industrious. I am sure you won't recognize it. But I should warn you, he is in mourning.
I'm sorry to hear, Granuel said. But why does that require warning?
Well,
Frigg pulled at imaginary tufts of hair on her chin, or else it was a sign language of some sort.
He's, you know, in mourning.
No, we don't know, I said. We've never seen a real Norse dwarf before.
I'll bet he doesn't have a Scottish accent. He won't be calling you laddie.
Oh, well, you're probably expecting the beard, but it won't be there, you see. They shave them off to express their grief. Instead of crying? Precisely. Would it be rude to ask why he's in mourning?
Grognuel asked. Frigg smiled.
You won't have to ask. He will tell you all about it. That's part of their process. And in truth, Druids, his story is why I'm here. If this doesn't convince you to help us against Fenris, nothing will. Oh, one more word of caution,
she said, pausing before the door.
He is a rune scald, so please forgive his unusual speech. Even in English, he tends to wax poetic.
She preceded us into the house, understanding that we'd want to have no one at our backs, and waited for us to enter. The interior had been utterly transformed. Where an old chewed-up beige carpet had rested, riddled with the piss and shit of untold numbers of rats, a gleaming hardwood floor awaited instead. The peeling wallpaper had been replaced with something new and warm. Well, that was probably a lie. The colors were actually cool, but I had once spent a purgatorial week forced to watch HGTV, and during that time I noticed that the hosts and designers described everything they wanted to do as warm. Even if they were working with ice blues, they were warm ice blues. I learned that warm was the best possible all-purpose adjective to use when remodeling. Homeowners couldn't hear the word enough. A designer could tell a couple that she was going to place a warm steel sculpture of Beera's frigid tits on top of a white marble pedestal in a walk-in freezer, and the couple would nod enthusiastically, blocking out everything except the warm. Let it be known, therefore, that the entire miraculous remodel of the foreman's manse was warm. Even the dwarf responsible for it, who was introduced to us as Fjallar, greeted us warmly. Fjallar was very clearly in mourning. His red-rimmed eyes regarded us tragically, and I did my best not to laugh at his sad little chin, a white-pocked moonlit gleaming underneath a pouting lower lip and the cantilevered overhang of his epic mustache. The reason dwarfs grow beards became obvious as he spoke. Their chins are too emotionally expressive, capable of quivering and frowning and lending the dwarf an air of vulnerability that they no doubt feel would attract unwelcome advances. His voice was a lusty, sonorous baritone, bereft of Scottish accent and thick with a Norse one, and he used it to invite us to a place at the table. I noticed that all his dark hair was braided into multiple lengths, not like dreadlocks, but not like any fashion I had seen before on males. Each length had something clasped or tied around it, usually gold or silver, but I saw colored strips of ribbon as well. He saw that I was curious about it and pointed to his braids with a thick finger.
Ye spy my braids, to be worn for a year and a day. Signs of mourning. Brother memories, friendship flags, and rings of clan and craft.
Yes, Frigg told us. I'm very sorry.
All will I tell ye, speaking fulsome time in hand,
he said.
For now, bread and mead call us, appetites whetted, to witness what I have been nursing, encased in iron, licked by flame, and tended with relish.
He waved grandly to a cook pot over a fire. The hearth looked good as new, and in front of it was a long wooden table with benches and candles. Pitchers of mead waited to be poured into drinking horns, and loaves of crusty bread waited in wooden bowls. Crossed axes and shields hung on the walls. Fjallar had done his best to turn the living room into a mead hall. A warm one. He ladled out a bowl for each of us, including Oberon, once we requested it. Fjallar looked to Frigg first to see if she was okay with it, and she shrugged her shoulders and said,
Druids.
Fjallar shrugged back and filled up a bowl for the hound. Oberon had nothing but praise for his meal.
Atticus, you really need to find out how he made this. If this is how Norse dwarfs cook every day, you need to make friends with them. Really? Seriously? I mean, really?
Okay, Oberon, I hear you.
But you're just sitting there. Clever girl, tell the dwarf he's awesome.
This is fabulous, Fjallar. I wish we could enjoy the hospitality of dwarfs more often, she said.
Thanks, Guanyuel. It's about time somebody listened to the hound. Now, tell him his chin looks like a dimpled golf ball.
Oberon made this last comment as Guanyuel was taking a sip of mead, listening to Fjallar's gracious reply. She managed both to spit mead and choke at the same time. Fjallar and Frigg looked alarmed, and I looked like an ass because I laughed. Oberon chuffed. You'd better get used to it, I said, pounding her on the back a couple of times. Because that's the way it's going to be. He's like that all the time.
Thanks for the timely heads up, she wheezed.
We then had to spend a few moments apologizing to our hosts for our terrible manners. After dinner was finished and we had showered Fjallar with another round of compliments and thanks, he cleared away the dishes and brought us cups of Irish coffee. Many thanks, Fjallar, I said. You've researched your guest's preference well.
Glad I am that I could so satiate you, for I have a tale long in the telling to share, if your leisure serves.
No doubt this has something to do with Loki, I said. The dwarf nodded.
It does.
We know some of it, I said. We saved Perrin from Loki in Arizona. Frigg's brows rose in surprise, and so did the impressive hedgerows above Fjallar's eyes.
Perrin lives?
Frigg asked. Aye, but his realm is indeed destroyed. He is now a guest of the Tuatha De Danann. Frigg leaned closer.
Did he say why Loki pursued him?
He said Loki had wanted to kill Thor, and since that option had been taken away from him, Perrin would have to do. Frigg made no comment, but shook her head to communicate her disapproval. Fjallar turned to her.
Then why, in the Nine Realms, did he come to us, fire-wreathed, rash and wanton, screaming after someone named Eldar?
Atticus, wait! Shut up!
That would be my fault, I said.
Damn it! You never listen!
Your fault,
Fjallar said. His eyes widened.
Ye sent Loki Truthslayer to Nidavellir.
Clever girl, quick, choke him.
Guanyuel twitched, but didn't follow through. I'm afraid so, I said. Sorry.
Ah, is the dwarf ever going to make tasty num-nums for us again? No, you've ruined everything.
Ye are responsible.
Fjallar began to rise from the table, and Frigg placed a soothing hand on his shoulder.
Fjallar, he is our guest, Frigg said.
He is our enemy,
the dwarf roared. Despite her attempt to make him sit, he rose, pointing at me.
Thoughtless tongue of a tiny mind, 7 times 700 shield brothers dead.
What?
I said.
Have patience. You see, he is unaware,
Frigg said.
He could not have known what Loki and Hel would do.
What did they do? I asked. Fjallar, please, I do not know what happened. Tell me what they did. The dwarf glared at me, his fingers itching for an axe. Frigg never removed her hand from his shoulder. He took several deep breaths, his chin mottled with bloodlust, until he finally mustered the will to take his seat calmly.
I suppose it is meet and proper,
he said,
that you should hear first why I mourn, beardless and braided. And then your woman and hound will know I have just cause. I'm truly honor-bound to cut you down.
Oberon growled at his words. Stop that this instant. Please, I said to him. Say on.
Perhaps if we had warning, horns sounded with alarm, we could have mustered a stronger defense, offered tapestries of wards and fire-tested stone. As it was, our defense faltered, heat ravaged, and our stone doors melted, slagged to ruin by the sulfur breath of volcanoes, Loki's fury unchained. Nidavellir opened to him. And he gave vent to his spleen, gall and bitterness churning in his eyes, madness made plain, spewing the venom he had choked down for so long in his bondage, deep in the darkness of that sepulchral cave. Our guards he set aflame, and then bellowed above their screaming, demanding that we produce the wretched construct, dwarf-crafted, known as Eldar. He paused for our answer, and we bore him honest tidings that nothing did we know of such a construct. But this he refused to believe, heart hardened against the truth. He who trades in lies like the winds trade in rumors of storms. Awash in fire, orange and yellow, he shot through tunnels and the noble caverns of Nidavellir, ancient dwarf home, solid sanctuary until that day. Deeper and deeper he delved, past our cities and into rough-hewn mines, and even past these until he burned the raw, untouched rock, the virgin flesh of the earth. We lost him somewhere in the dark, his flames extinguished, his shrill demands for Eldar fallen silent, grave still, not even a whisper of misplaced anger in the abyss. Then we wondered, and we sent out queries to Asgard, Vanaheim, and elsewhere. How had Loki won free? Was Ragnarok begun? Who was Eldar? There are many dwarfs who hold that name, but none of the king's smiths had crafted a construct of that calling. We heard first from Odin Allfather, far-seeing wise ruling. He warned us to beware of Hel, cold and cunning, and to look for her spies in our realm. She must not learn that Loki was in Nidavellir. Straightway we searched, seized, and questioned. Her minions, death rattlers, stringy shadows of the eternal forlorn, we found in abundance and held them captive. But our prudence came too late, availed us not. Too open had we been about Loki's arrival, too free with our questions and messages. Hel could not fail to hear that Loki Giantborn had come to Nidavellir, losing flame and voice and pain-racked visage in the black of some pit far beyond where we feast and work and dwell. To my shoulders fell the weight of the mountain, for such is the weight of my king's command. King Arveng, son of Vestri, golden-maned, mighty thewed, many-wived, bold in battle, spake unto the king's smith, who in turn spake unto me, and my task was made plain. The stone arms, the king's own hammers, needed armor to withstand Loki, proof against fire, wards against his wrath. I am a runescald, one of seven, senior most and filled with lore, who emblazons armor with the truth of runes, elemental forms matched to thought and deed and purpose. Weapons, too, carved with kennings both old and new, that I sing betwixt my workshop walls, always imbuing steel and stone with the poetry of life, the songs of war. It had never been done before, warding armor so well against fire, that a dwarf could withstand the implacable malice of Loki Kinslayer, flame-haired cruelty, molten-tempered mischief. But I was not asked if it could be done. I was told to make it so. I sang to the steel, and struggled with the runes for a 7 day, yet could not find the form and song that would keep steel cool in fire. In perversity, desperation-driven, I plied my craft on leather, and surprisingly found a measure of success. Pursuing it further, doubly determined, I sang of skin-sealed moisture, sinews hardened with courage, tanned hide of taut resolve that deflects danger, and of surfaces chapped instead of burned. And the runes I crafted were oblong and rounded, heat shedding shapes of domed protection, sigils of steadiness in the face of fury, waves of quenching water to drown licking fingers of fire. Into the smithy's flames I tossed two shields of leather, one of my scaldic craft and one bereft of my attention. The standard shield burned, while the scaldic shield only charred and blackened around the edges. Heart swollen and pride puffed, I applied my hard-won skills to a set of armor, and it was during this time that Hell's army came to Nidavellir. News of her father had reached her pestilent ears, cold with patient malice. Swiftly, she assembled legions of Draugr to invade our mountain, defile our homes, stain the beauty of our axe-hewn halls. They came with weapons drawn, modern rifles like our smiths now make, shooting into our tunnels but never spreading out, always marching deeper, past our treasures and warrens of riches. Many thousands were they, yet so were we, and determined to stop them, for now we thought Ragnarok had begun. The hammer horn sounded throughout Nidavellir, and the stone arms assembled, and with them the Black Axes, the Shield Brothers, the Maidens of Wrath, and the Guardians of Lore. Miners and craftsmen, merchants and millers, all were called to martial arms. All of them answered, abandoning the day's cares for the defense of the realm, save for myself and the rune scalds by especial command of King Arvang. "You must remain in your workshops ever diligent," he said, "and continue crafting the armor to slay the Father of Lies whensoever we find him." And so, battle was joined without my hammer, and the king's scalds will never sing of my valor around the hearths of my people. Here is what they sing instead. Grim-visaged and stout-hearted, dwarfs young and old, yet shield brothers all, march to meet the shambling blue Draugr of Hell, detested queen of frosted twilight. Her army, unbreathing, steeped in the attar of woe, unleashed a hail of bullets, stolen weapons from the mines of Midgard. Deafening thunder roared through Nidavellir that day, rattling teeth and rifle fire and ringing shields and battle cries. Four-armed skaldic runes on shields and helmets, the front line advanced undaunted, metal pieces flying back at the foe, ragged soldiers who knew no honor in life. They, heedless of any harm below the neck, bore the ricochets in silence. The Shield Brothers pressed forward, unwitting of their coming doom. Cunning Hell, bride of ice and despair, gave commands in tombstone whispers to her soldiers, who raised their weapons and fired at the ceiling above the Shield Brothers. Bullets whipping off rocks, tearing through flesh from above, felling many who never struck a blow for their clans, never hewed a head from its shoulders. The front line marched on, and behind them quick-witted shield brothers raised their skaldic wards, redirected ricochets, foiled the efforts of Hell. And finally, when the armies met, the Draugr learned of the strength of dwarfs. Rotted skulls flew from rotted bodies as axes swept the air over shields, while others were trampled under the vanguard and hewn apart by subsequent ranks. The Draugr shrank back at first. Their orderly advance exploded, but then they swelled as corpses will with blowflies and maggots, filled the tunnel with their unholy bodies, halted our advance and held their line, while their back ranks emptied magazines above the Shield Brothers' heads, ceaseless ammunition thrown up to tear us down. And some found targets after 2, 3, or 4 ricochets. Slowly, by attrition, the Draugr took their toll, slaying noble dwarfs in heat and noise and close rock walls with cowardly attacks. The dead soldiers of Hell pushed back, advanced again despite the best efforts of the valiant Shield Brothers, courageous warriors to the last. Bodies of their dwarven brethren, slick with blood, impeded both retreat and advance. The wounded, no matter how they cried for help, could not be tended in that close tunnel with so many enemies to fight. Naught but enduring agony, desperate breath, and despair was their lot, until their honorable deaths brought them peace and immortal glory. Back, back beneath the onslaught, the Shield Brothers gave ground, slowly yet inexorably, pushed by the juggernaut of Hell's army. Yet every footstep was dearly won, for it took hours for the Draugr to travel the distance a dwarf may walk in 5 minutes, crawling over the massed dead. And in that time, assembling in the Grand Cavern, a mighty force of Shield Brothers awaited, ready to protect the market and residences and streets there. Ricochets would not be so effective in the Grand Cavern, and the Shield Brothers had firearms of their own. So when the tunnel forces were pushed back to the cavern, they abruptly retreated on a signal from their general, fell behind the lines, and allowed the Draugr to walk into an ambush. Thousands of shambling soldiers were mown down by a fusillade from dwarf-made guns, and a furious cry of victory echoed in the cavern. Blue and twitching, heads shattered by bullets, the Draugr fell in ranks, turned to foul dust, leaving their weapons behind. Yet still they came, innumerable as ants or the swarms of summer bees, and after we had slain 1,000 with unremitting fire, they paused, and we entertained hopes that our resolve had taught Hell to reconsider her rash invasion of Nidavellir. But then they flooded once again through the opening, yet with this cruel difference. They held the bulletproof Skaldic shields of our fallen brothers in front of their heads, and thus we could not slay them, only poke holes in their rotted flesh, slow them for a time with a shattered thigh bone, a pulverized ankle, nothing more. And then the chill craft of Hell manifested itself, and we shuddered in horror at her plan, for every piece of it represented the death of a Shield Brother in the tunnel. The Draugr began to make a wall of shields, 3 high, linking them together, and then creating another column, by which method they created a corridor that would allow them to maneuver in safety. And it was indeed a corridor. Strangely, the Draugr made no attempt to advance in the cavern, to advance on our treasures, to reach for our lives or destroy our homes. Putting aside their modern weapons, the Shield Brothers charged with axes and hammers to break the wall, and the resultant clash of arms thundered in the great cavern as Draugr were beheaded and dwarfs were shot by the defiant minions of Hell. Reports came back that the Draugr were advancing through and past the cavern as fast as they could move, their objective elsewhere, their purpose unclear. And then in the court of King Arvang, as Fartalf bowed, ambassador to the Dark Elves, longtime resident of our realm, and announced he brought a message from Hell,
she having no other way to speak to us in safety. Speak, King Irving said, his fury palpable. And then be gone from my realm. We will have no traffic with Svartalfheim henceforth for this betrayal.
My people should not be punished for bearing you a message,
the ambassador said.
Especially since it may save the lives of many dwarves. Will you hear me in patience? Rashness reigned, ire checked with prudence.
Our king made no promises. Speak your part, Svartalf, he said. The dark elf simpered and bowed again.
Hel wishes me to say she has no designs on your realm and wishes no more harm to the noble dwarves of Nidavellir. She simply searches for her father, Loki, whom she has heard is currently visiting. Her army will not attack dwarves except in self-defense or if their progress is impeded.
And when she finds her father, what then? King Arvang roared. Wrath awakened, patience fled. Will she reduce my tunnels to rubble, set my caverns aflame, slaughter my people?
Nay, noble king,
the Svartalf replied.
She will leave with him if she can, containing his madness so far as she is able. Her quarrel is with Asgard and Vanaheim, not the honorable people of Nidavellir.
Have you aught else to say? The king asked.
My message is complete, sire.
Then remove yourself from my presence and my realm. I never wish to see ye more. When the Svartalf had gone, chastised yet unrepentant, the king sent for me. I rushed to answer his summons on bended knee. Runeskald Fjallar, he said, long have you labored for a greater good as a poet and enchanter of armor. Now I must ask of you a service befitting a hero. Retrieve the dead man's shroud and wear it yourself. Follow Hel's hordes and discover what they intend, then report back to me. Slay none except in the utmost extremity. You must live to return the shroud and speak of her plans. It shall be done, sire, I said, and wept as I bowed deeply to him. Never had I been asked for so weighty a service. The dead man's shroud was crafted centuries before my time by the greatest of all runeskalds, Mjotvanger, son of Hrothsvith, nimble-fingered, honey-throated, unmatched scion of clever craft. The shroud may be worn only by runeskalds, but once worn, it convinces the dead that the wearer is also dead. There is no copy, for none have ever duplicated the skald of Mjotvanger. His runes exist for all to see, but the dread words he sang while crafting the shroud are forever lost. Orders given, I was led to the king's treasury and presented the dead man's shroud, sacred relic of my forebear's skill. I collected my skaldic shield, fire-tested, then was ushered to the front lines of the Shield Brothers, where battle still raged. Rather than try to break through the wall, where I would be exposed to gunfire, I was vaulted bodily over it on the premise that I would draw no fire once I landed, shroud-wrapped, disguised from dead eyes. I landed heavily but intact, drew stairs but no fire. Identity concealed, purpose hidden, I joined the stream of dead forward through my own realm, an invader of my own home. What a wonder Runeskald Mjotvanger had made. I marched unremarked in the midst of putrefaction, cold malice, and unknown intention.
past warrens and neighborhoods, and then past mines and pockets of wealth, I followed the stream of dead ever downward. And then, after seemingly interminable hours of this journey, so far down I knew not where I was, the Draugr before and behind me stopped, and pressed themselves against the wall of the tunnel we traversed. I did likewise, waiting, breath heaving in a passage where no other breath heaved, until a giant of a dog rushed past. Hell's own hound, named Garm, of yellow eyes and unmatched determination, nose following a trail I could not smell, doubtless made of malignance and the acrid trace of sulfur. The dead, and I as well, continued after him, always coursing down into the unlit depths where no dwarf had roamed for years. When the darkness became too much for my eyes to pierce, the shroud did me a service and lit my way, alarming none in the process. After another hour of peregrination, I entered a vast chamber already full of Draugr. There, high up on a ledge, glowed the resting form of Loki Firebreath, supine on the rocks, slumbering in peace, only his bare skin revealing a blue aura of simmering flames. Garm sat beside him, stalwart sentinel, ever vigilant. The legions of Hell made no move to wake him, but rather faced outward, ready to face any threat, and there they still wait at this very moment, protecting the sleep of Loki, Hell's father, lord of mischief. I hurried back to tell my king of this news, and grimly he sent word to Asgard of Hell's doings in Nidavellir. Her father found, Hell's goal was accomplished, and the dead stopped flowing into Nidavellir. But still they wait silently far below our cities for Loki, robed in wrath, to waken again. More than 10,000 Draugr fell that day to dwarf weapons. 700 shield brothers fell defending their homes, their children left fatherless, their women widowed, and for what? For a selfish god's nap in the deep. For a druid's foolish tongue. You see me here, beardless and braided, for the loss of an uncle and a nephew in that battle. Why should I not now, in justice draped, exact a measure of the blood shed for a careless word 3 months ago? My fallen family demands it, as do the families of all the dwarfs who died that day.
You will not move,
Frigg said to Fjallar, her voice as cold as his was hot with rage.
Do not stir to shepherd violence here. These are your guests and mine.
The dwarf looked apoplexed.
But my honor
will restrain itself for a while longer,
Frigg finished.
Odin has a plan that will pay your people properly and tax the druid heavily.
What plan is that? I asked.
You already know it well. Now is the time,
Frigg said,
while Loki and Hel are occupied, while Garm is stationed elsewhere, to cripple their efforts to bring about Ragnarok. Hel's realm is half empty. There you must go to slay Loki's spawn Fenris, Odin's bane, devourer of gods.
You want me to go to Hel and kill Fenris?
Yes.
I thought he was supposed to be tied up on an island in the middle of a black lake. Frigg rolled her eyes and waved this away.
Snorri Sturluson made that up. He was bound in Hel, and there he remains, tended by her minions.
I can't get into Hel. I knew the shift points to get to the plains of Nidavellir and Jotunheim. The first was in Iceland and the other in Siberia. But I'd never tracked down the shift point that would take me to the third route of Yggdrasil, which would lead me all the way down to the spring of Vergelmir and the lower realms of the Norse.
Untrue. None other than the goddess Freya will lead you there. She is your guide and your surety of return.
I snorted. Forgive me, Frigg, but Freya is no surety of my return. Not after what happened in Oslo 6 years ago. Say rather that you're holding a shotgun to my head and Freya will pull the trigger.
She besmirched the honor of the Easter that day, but none more so than her own. This is her penance. Only by your safe return can she restore her good name.
And once I'm returned from hell, will she attack me then, her oath fulfilled?
No, of course not. But you are not going alone. In addition, good King Arvang has already promised the services of the Black Axes.
The Black Axes?
Fjallar exclaimed.
How many of them?
All of them. You will lead an army to kill a single wolf.
He's not an average wolf, and you know it, I said. What is Loki up to?
It is something akin to the Odin sleep,
Frigg said.
He is healing. He has not had a decent night's rest in centuries. He is drained, and now he heals for an indeterminate time.
So he'll be even stronger when he wakes.
Yes.
Will he still be batshit insane?
His sanity has always been doubtful. He once tied a rope to the beard of a nanny goat and the other end to his testicles just to make Scotty laugh. It was an extremely high-pitched tug of war, and his idea of kindness. If you are wondering if he will be less likely to pursue malevolent impulses than in the past, my guess would be no.
Can Freya get us into hell without having to fight through legions of Draugr?
Yes. You will take the path that the Aesir use.
For a while, no one spoke. Eyes shifted around the table, measuring expressions, and wood popped and crackled in the hearth. This was precisely the sort of thing that Odin had requested of me some years before. Since I had been directly or indirectly responsible for the deaths of many of those tasked to fight in Ragnarok, I had to take on some of their responsibilities. Fenris had to be slain, and we would find no better opportunity than this, while he was still bound in hell and many of her forces were absent. My hound stays here, I said, safe and unmolested.
No, I want to go with you.
No, we are not arguing about this. I need you to be safe.
But I'm always safe with you.
You wouldn't be in hell.
And your apprentice?
Frigg asked. She's not my apprentice anymore. She is a full druid and may make her own decisions, I said. I turned to Granuel and spoke softly. You are not under any obligation to accompany me. You should remain here and do something heinous to your stepfather's oil business. Take Oberon with you. Granuel's green eyes bored into mine. Her head shook minutely, and she brought up her left hand to caress my beard.
Idiot, I'm going with you. My decision.
Okay.
Can I go if I call you an idiot and stroke your face with my paw?
No. Oberon whined.
This isn't fair.
One of us has to live through this. I always want you to be the one who lives.
What if you don't come back?
Go down to Ore and find someone there who likes big friendly dogs.
They wouldn't call me Oberon. They call me Max. You know how many big dogs are named Max? Like, all of them. Atticus, don't go. Just send a poison box of doggy treats to this wolf and forget about it. He hasn't seen any heist movies.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Well, I've always been smarter than you.